Good. All right, so we're in Bava Basra. We're on page 7b of Bava Basra. There are two packages, one of the Hebrew, the Vilna Shas coming around, the copies of the page of Talmud, and one of the Art Scroll idiomatic translation. And just a reminder about the Mishnah. So the Mishnah said that we compel unwilling residents to participate in the co-op funds that are necessary. Not exactly co-op. That wasn't the exact
common
system.
Charges.
But the common charges that would be required of those residents within a courtyard, and the common charges of those residents that would be within the city. And we didn't talk about it on this level, but we have to ask ourselves the question, are we talking about regular taxation? Are we talking about special funds for defense? For privacy? At what level does this kind of requirement, financial obligation, really sit in terms of the community that we're building? Let's remember that the chatzer, the way that somebody lives, is in a small kind of, what we said, chet shape, right? Like this, and there you share a courtyard. And the city itself, in traditional terms, we're talking about, quote-unquote, not city-states, but small city administrative areas, if you will, that are run by a certain number of people. If we use the Gemara's internal system, that's a system of 12 very important people, or 7 very important people, and those people, the Ziknei Ha'ir, the elders of the city, are put into place by the people who are called Anshei Ha'ir, the people of the city, and the people of the city, the Mishnah defined, at least those people who are residents of a city, in terms of the co-op funds that they have to participate with in the creation of a gateway and a doorway, in terms of the courtyard or the gateway, the double doors and the crossbar, the locking bar, in terms of a city. We know who those Anshei Ha'ir are, according to the Mishnah. They are people who either live there, what, 12 months? Or they've, what? They've bought property. Okay? So they bought property, they immediately become part of the Anshei Ha'ir, the people of the city. They live there 12 months, renting, part of the city. As a boarder somewhere, part of the city, 12 months. They're responsible, obligated for these funds, a gateway and a door for the courtyard, and a gateway, a double door, and vrichim, the crossbar, for the city. And we don't know whether or not that is a special assessment for defense, a special assessment for privacy, a regular good old tax. We don't have a name for this fund here. I'm just pointing this out.
Yeah, but you have a target where the money goes to.
You have a target, but I'm just saying it hasn't been called anything. This isn't like the person shall pay taxes to the city in this Mishnah, and it is therefore his obligation to pay the city tax. What does the city tax cover? It covers X, Y, Z. It doesn't say that. It says you can require the person to pay when this obligation really to build this comes, because you live in this courtyard or because you live in this city. And Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says you should be mindful of this fact. Interesting way the Mishnah puts it. Not every chatzer, not every courtyard requires a gateway and a door. And not every iria, not every municipality or city or city unto itself requires a wall and a double door and the crossbeam and the locking beam. Did Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel in the Mishnah clarify exactly what he meant why some do and why some don't? No. Where does the Mishnah go? Interestingly, a little bit like we might expect the Gemara to go, but we see kind of an internal question in a Mishnah sometimes to clarify terms in and of itself, the Mishnah. That's when we get the clarification of who's actually a resident in the city. So important first is the person, we understand who the person is, who really is obligated to participate in any of this communal funding of these projects. Now, in terms of the actual structures that we talked about, we said that a gateway and a doorway is most likely in the center of some type of wall that for a courtyard, some type of wall. It has a little gatehouse, and the person sits and kind of is there because we ultimately decided who were the people that might come visit this courtyard, because we saw this in the story of the man who was participating in the building of these required aspects of what you need in a courtyard. And then Elijah the prophet, who used to come visit him, says, I can't come visit that guy anymore. Who were the people that we were worried about in terms of that story?
The poor
people. The poor people, right? And because ultimately, in that story, Elijah sits with this guy and doesn't come visit him anymore, and we're interested to know. And we saw in the Rashi that we were talking about the ability for poor people to actually make their way into the space, into the space, into the courtyard by themselves. And we were at the level of courtyard residents in that passage. And what was the nafka mina, just so we would do a little bit of chazara on the whole story, why did we say that Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet, stopped visiting this guy who...
There was no knob? He couldn't open the gate.
It was a knob placed incorrectly. It was an unwelcoming knob.
It was a double barrier.
It made it for a double barrier, and that the knob.
Yeah, but if the double barrier was to correctly put knobs, then there shouldn't be a problem.
Okay, but still, it was unwelcoming. It's the issue, and that you know, if I have to knock because there's no way to open the door out here, it feels less than inviting. This is potentially what we're discussing in terms of our own communities, how that works and how it doesn't work. This was a little bit of an issue that we talked about. And Ad Kan, we kind of stopped there and saw that Elijah the prophet has a lot to say in the Gemara, and we went and talked a little bit about Elijah's presence in different Gemaras, and we talked especially about the story about going into the ruins to pray, and that Elijah, who waited at the gatehouse, if you will, out there, was waiting at the gatehouse to tell this man that he needed to learn something about choosing this ruin in which to pray. And we talked about Elijah potentially being representative of the poor and the less well off, and that we ultimately see that in Elijah's story, even though it didn't say in our story, you better come and learn a value, what it means to do something in Jewish life. You better learn a little bit, better think twice about the way you've done something. If Elijah appears in the story, it's like a teacher telling you, is that really the way you want to do it? Because of the Brachot story, where Elijah really was the teacher and did ask the people to reconsider where they were praying in this ruin in Jerusalem, here in our Gemara, we reread our Gemara and we said, Elijah must be asking us about how we ultimately build a gateway and a door in our courtyard.
If the purpose of this Mishnah is tzedakah and to teach...
The purpose of the Mishnah is an introduction to a space, a city, a courtyard, in which the issue of tzedakah will come up for the rabbis in the Gemara, but the Mishnah itself is not about tzedakah.
I just wondered if Bava Batra is about tzedakah.
Pages will get into the issue of tzedakah. I've chosen these pages out of Bava Batra to show you this is a classic location of where the issue of tzedakah, the topic of tzedakah, is being discussed. But the Mishnah, this Mishnah itself, so far, was not necessarily about tzedakah, except to say that the creation of these passageways, the gatehouse, the doors, etc., all had everything to do with the poor of your community.
So why would they choose building of a gatehouse and a door as examples of how to treat the poor people?
Because these physically were the passageways through which poor people would come. They didn't have kind of the soup kitchen over here that registered the people. These were areas that, in the gatehouses, where they knew who was going in and out of a certain area, could keep track of who was going in and out of a certain number of homes here, and there were things in the public courtyard that maybe they wanted to really keep track of, and it could be a security issue. It could be just a public in and out issue. It could be that also at the gate of the city, this is where they registered who was really coming into our city at all. And this gateway of the city was the place, biblical times to Talmudic times, where, outside of Jerusalem and the Sanhedrin and these kinds of things, where a Beit Din might have sat, where the market might have gathered. This gate was a very important place to understand how to take your head tax. If you took your tax by way of head tax, that's going to be an issue today, by the way. And so what we said was that tzedakah is inherently in here. It's in here, even though the Mishnah itself is really about the co-op fee thus far. And it could be about more than just the tzedakah issue. It is. The wall of the city is not just about tzedakah and the poor people coming through the gate. The wall of the city is going to be about whatever walls of cities are about, and I'm going to let the Gemara speak to what walls of the city are really about.
Put a wall, you say.
No, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel reminds us that not every city needs a wall. Am I missing? Am I?
Yes. Wall is a topical word.
Oh, I'm in 2,000 years ago.
Yeah. So, Rabbi, what
we live 2,000 years ago.
That's where I'd rather be right now.
I'm there.
How do you characterize Bava Batra?
Bava Batra is the last gate. Three gates in the Talmud deal with legal issues and civil issues and civic issues. Bava Kama, the first gate. Bava Metzia, the middle gate. Bava Batra, the last gate. Three Masechtot of the Gemara at the beginning of the order of Nezikin, the order that we call damages,
right,
dealing with, again, laws, both civil and criminal. And this one happens to be the third in the three Masechtot.
In terms of the responsibility of the citizens, of the residents, even unwilling citizens and unwilling residents, what about the Ger Toshav?
The Ger Toshav is, by this standard, let's just use the standards we have when we learn Mishnah, we sometimes do this.
12 months
he's in. Doesn't it? We're not talking about religious status, we're not talking about if he's joining a minyan, we're not talking about... He's there, though, for sure. And if he's a poor, somebody asked me the last time, are we talking about the poor who are only Jewish, are we talking about the poor who are mixed? My answer is, poor who are mixed. So some want to argue, maybe some of the Rishonim, that it's only we're talking about Jewish poor. Well, we're talking about a mixed crowd here in any of these cities where there were some mixed populations. We know that in Talmudic times.
So Ger Toshav means resident or something?
What's a resident who's dwelling with you, who may not be Jewish.
Ger means resident. What does Toshav mean?
Who's sitting and dwelling with you, like Yoshev.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Good. It's a reminder to define our terms here. All right? So that's where we are right now. Good, Arthur, that you clarified that, because yes, it's about tzedakah, and no, it's not about tzedakah. We're really in questions about how we build our cities and our homes, but the point I'm making is that the Jewish ethic, in terms of building these spaces out, if we were really using the Jewish ethic to do so, we would be using the ethics that are within the civic administration laws, building codes that we have in the Gemara. Right? And so we're going to see what those are. So, good. We now understand why Eliyahu didn't visit with this guy, this chassid, this supposed pious person. And we're going to go on the front of the packet. Do you want another packet over there? You just need one?
Yeah.
You sure? Okay. So, we're on the right-hand column of 7b2. And we're going to look at the part of the Mishnah that says, Kofin oto livnot beit sha'ar v'delet l'chatzer. Okay? we compel an unwilling resident to help build a gatehouse and a door for the courtyard.
First of all, it's not to help them, the forcing to build. But the question is, before we started, we talked about participating, paying money to build.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about.
Now it's...
No, it's just talking about money.
Okay.
It's not talking about, like, you're coming to help build the sukkah. It means financial participation. You'll please forgive me. I must shed one layer. And I've just come back from a retreat at the Kutz camp up in Warwick, New York, which was beautiful. And I smell like a fire because we sat around the fire.
That's a nice smell.
It is, but in case you're feeling like something's burning, I'm telling you it's nothing except my sweater is full of that smoke, okay?
So marshmallows out of your pocket.
Yeah, yeah. There were lots of M&Ms, and I didn't eat the marshmallows. I didn't eat many M&Ms either, but it was very nice. At the nighttime, it's called Rabbinic Visionary Leadership Fellowship. And among, there were 10 of us chosen for this cohort, second cohort, through UJA Federation and through some of the channels of leadership building Jewish communal professional work, this cohort was seated. It was very interesting. 3 conservative rabbis, 3 Orthodox rabbis, 4 Reform rabbis. And some wonderful, wonderful both Jewish professionals coming to teach about what it means to be a leader and grow your leadership and vision and how to work with communities of excellence to create more of the culture that we love, and also to hear a report from the field about really what's happening in the Jewish world. And they have professionals from the Jewish community who come and do the leadership building, and professionals from the corporate world, and professionals from the world of American culture, to talk about the global and American cultural influences that we should be aware of to not only take back into our precincts to see if it's something that might attach within our synagogue culture, but that the synagogue culture should be aware of so that potentially you could understand more of what people are embracing or engaged with in life outside of the walls. So long story short, one of the chief and expert storytellers from The Moth was at this retreat.
Great.
We talked about story building techniques and willingness to hear each other's stories in the context of synagogue community. I thought back to our Shavuot Tikkun. Anybody who was here on Shavuot night, we had 3 women talk about their processes of converting to Judaism, sharing very personal stories, and some were humorous and some were touching and some were teary. And we then told this storyteller all about all the stories that exist within the Talmud and in our Mishnah and in our Midrash. He was blown away, literally blown away. And different people around this fire told different stories, told about where they're studying, what stories they're studying. I spoke about our Elijah story and our connecting one Elijah story in one place to an Elijah story in another, and how originally, most likely, right, this one knew an Elijah story from, they came from the Galil, and it was a conference where these folks from Beersheba knew that Elijah story, and these Chachamim, these sages brought their Elijah story, and that sage brought his, and they sat and they shared stories, and the production of our sacred texts really was from that kind of oral experience of story and then being combined. And I said, you should think in terms of The Moth. If 4 or 5 stories hit a theme, you might want to collect them.
They always do a theme.
They always do a theme. So he told me that it's curated that way.
Absolutely.
And I said, now you'll have to invite people to write commentaries.
But the interesting thing about The Moth is that they coach the storyteller. First of all, it has to be, it's a specific length, it cannot be any longer, and also they coach them about how to craft that story and how to make the arc of the story. So they're short and they're really well done. Yeah, they're compelling. Because you can have a good story and not tell it well.
So this was our challenge.
Right.
This is our challenge. It's true. Anyhow, so back to the Beit Midrash. So here we are. We're compelling this person to build a gatehouse, and the Bright is now going to explain why indeed Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel spoke up and said, look, not every chatzer really requires this. Look down at the bottom at the little drawing, though. You see it down at the bottom? So let's unpack that drawing, because we have to understand the drawing first. Okay, so you have what's called in parlance, go to the bottom of the little drawing, Rishus HaRabim. Right? Everybody see that?
Mm-hmm.
That means the public domain, the street upon which many, 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 many pass. Okay? So if I created an Eruv for Shabbat, meaning that area that I can carry within, I can't go into that major thoroughfare if there's really major, major traffic on that thoroughfare. I can't create that into private space, even in the theoretical way I can with other space, like a mavoi. See that mavoi? That is an alleyway. Best translation we have. And you see that there, in this case, are four different entrances to four different courtyards. And you see that it's not set up exactly like the chet that I explained. This is a drawing that you see in footnote 25. In Mishnah times, several courtyards commonly opened into one alleyway, which in turn led to a public thoroughfare. Those courtyards near the entrance to the Mavoi would require a gatehouse, even according to Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Well, that's where we're going to arrive after we look at some of the text. Which, actually, but the Rashut HaRabim, the major thoroughfare, and which do not. And this is what the Gemara is going to tell us Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel is thinking about. Back up to the text. Tanya. It was taught in a Braita. This is the word that always introduces the Braita. Remember, the Braita is a text from the same era as the Mishnah. It is a text that would have been around the same time as Mishnaic text produced. It was remembered, like the Mishnah was remembered, as a text in and of itself, as a lesson that could be brought in a discussion of a Mishnah in order to create some argument, rhetoric about the Mishnah itself. Same period of time, didn't make it into the Mishnah, a text that exists, so I'm going to now hold it up and say, wait a minute, here's what we have. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, lo kol chatzerot reuyot levet sha'ar. Not all courtyards require a gatehouse. Ela, here, is going to expand on it, unlike our Mishnah. He's going to expand on it in the Braita, because the Mishnah only went that far. Not all require it. What? Ela, chatzer hasmucha l'reshut harabim, reuya levet sha'ar. The courtyard that is actually adjoining a public thoroughfare or abuts the public thoroughfare, that is one that requires a gatehouse, and the opposite, v'she'ena smucha l'reshut harabim, and if it's not exactly next to the public thoroughfare, eina re'uya l'veit sha'ar. It does not require the gatehouse that we were discussing in the Mishnah. Therefore what? What have I done in terms of Mishnah and Gemara now? I've taken my Mishnah, where he said, very in shorthand, lo chol ha-chatzerot ru'uyot levet sha'ar. I did not require, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, every one of these courtyards to have a gatehouse and a door. And you, when you were reading the Mishnah, because this is what we did last week, we said, really? What does he mean? And now the Gemara, where someone in the Beit Midrash has the Braita tradition, has the other text to present in the discussion, says, oh, I understand what the Mishnah did. The Mishnah must have been recalling what it says in this Braita. this brayta exists outside the Mishnah. Let me tell you what Rav Shimon ben Gamliel meant. He meant where it was mamash there on the Rashut HaRabim. It was really right next to this thoroughfare. Yes, it needs it. But if it's not there, you don't need it. Why? The one closest, even if the drawing is what the drawing says it is, and it's not directly open to the public thoroughfare, because you want all the time the alleyway to be the alley that you turn down so that then you go into the building. You know, it's kind of like some of those buildings on Park Avenue where the address is Park Avenue. But in order to get in, you have to turn on 91st or 92nd Street. And you go in the side there, right? But it's still the address, the awning, is the Park Avenue address. So this is the reality, and those that have the chatzer wall, like number 1 and 2 in the drawing below, they require it. But number 3 and 4, they don't. Okay, so why would that be? Why would it be that 1 and 2 need it and 3 and 4 don't?
Close to the main
road. Traffic, sort of moving
yeah, I mean, I think those two should pitch in personally. Because
no, they get their own.
If you go on the, if you take that alley, you could go into any one of them.
Ah, so good. So hold that. If they take that alley, Rabbanan and Rabbanan, the Gemara asks, and what do the rabbis think about that idea? Well, Zimnin de dechake b'nei Rashut HaRabim. Sometimes, Zimnin, the Dachake, B'nai Rashut HaRabim. Sometimes, those who are traveling on the public thoroughfare, it gets really it's really crowded. And, V'ailu V'atu. And some will go up the Mavoi and come by a courtyard far from the entrance in order to escape the traffic.
Just to loiter or to get some...
Ah, well, that's the question.
Well, they may not know that it doesn't lead to anything else by mistake.
Oh, so if it's wide open, maybe I think it's just a continued system of alleyways.
It's just a dead end.
Yeah, they didn't make those big yellow signs. You know, we've not found in any archaeological dig so far a big sign that says dead end. Barry, they might start
what
looking
if
at
it. They had a whole book if they had that.
Could have saved the whole massacre.
I had assumed that the Mavoi, but in case, I assumed that four smaller ones wouldn't have one at all.
Oh, nice. So that is a question that ultimately I had a discussion today with a colleague about when we were learning a little bit of this Gemara. I was telling him what we're going to learn tonight.
Repeat that, Jay. What did you say?
I had just assumed from the drawing that the Mavoi, that the alleyway itself would have, that's where the gatehouse would be. And the four small courtyards would not be.
Right.
What Jay is saying, let's economize on our building project here. Let's put a gatehouse right off Rashut HaRabim and make sure that all of us collectively contribute. So I don't have a good answer for you, but I'm looking.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm just saying I'm surprised.
I don't yet have a good answer for you, but I'm looking. I need to buy the Mativta, like we've had for some Masechtot, that really has all the Rishonim and all of the Halachic responsa dealing with these matters.
Yeah. It could be the Mavoi, because it's a part of a city zoning, we're not allowed to put
You're right. Mavoi. You're right. And we could...
Because the Mavoi is part of the public domain of the city. And nobody is allowed to do...
Yeah, it could very well be.
I'm impressed that the traffic could be so heavy as to having people moving all...
Well, let's put it this way. I was also thinking about that a little bit. During market days, it would seem to me that if a city was big enough to have these kinds of alleyways off of what's being called Rashut HaRabim, and we're talking about cities that have walls and gateways and double doors and locks, I think that probably the market days were a matter of discussion, because you don't really plan the whole city for the swell of people who come on those kinds of days.
And that was Monday and Thursday.
Yeah.
Torah reading.
Right.
Well, actually, the individual Katsuotir, they're not necessarily purely residential, are they, in the sense that people could be running small craft studios or businesses out of their homes.
Right. Right, and there's all kinds of law.
So they need access.
Maybe. Maybe. I think you may be right. The question is whether or not there's any kind of discussion about if a person owns a business and they wanted to hang a shingle and they wanted to have traffic and they wanted to be near that Rosh Hashanah. And that's what we would be looking for in terms of, I think, some of the tshuvot that might come around this subject. And I also, for that matter, really would love more about how those small businesses were organized. Some of the Mishnah deals with not having factories that smell within residential areas and being careful about what we allow for in terms of the development of business within residential areas. And seems to, in the Tosefta, even suggest that there are certain areas that become business districts. And we know a little bit more about those business districts in terms of the competition from things like Hasagat Rule. And it seems like there's some real urban planning ideas going on within these Masechtot and Ezekiel, in that matter. And so I'm not sure how many small craft studios are in and out of the alleyways, kind of Nachla Odish, to think about it that way. Seems more likely that there are business districts. But again, some of those alleyways would be the passageways to get there.
So if you're building a gatehouse at 1 and 2, that leaves 3 and 4 unprotected.
If they are for protection.
Right. If they're for protection.
That's true.
Or keeping people out. Then those are unprotected.
We're not exactly sure it's for protection when it comes to a chaser. We're not sure if they're worried so deeply about protection per se. We do get a sense from the first story after this Mishnah that it is about the poor of the area being regulated, at least, in terms of...
Why did you find
it before? If there was a business in the chatzer, it might be that you have some materials there and you don't want to make it... You want to make it about security of your business and material. Protected from what? Like, are we really worried that even the invaders would come to take life? Or are we worried about property? And if those gate houses and doors were about protection of property and wealth,
security.
Right? And then you have the issue of privacy. We're not really sure that it's totally about privacy, but there is some degree of inherent privacy that comes along with that kind of build-out. And the question of the rabbis is, to what degree are we really requiring all this? And to what degree are we, as a society, really saying to both numbers 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 that you've got to participate in 1 and 2 when 3 and 4 are not required? So wait a minute. So that's really the issue now that I want to bring forward, which is a bigger issue within this part of the Gemara we're going to be studying in the next couple of passages itself. In the micro, already here, this brings up the question. In terms of my participation in the co-op or in the courtyard's zoning and needs, building needs, if we only say, like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, that numbers 1 and 2, let's say we held by him, and 3 and 4 don't need them, but all members of the chaser, meaning in this case, I have to kind of expand my thinking, meaning the alleyway, the mavoi, all members of the mavoi have to participate. That's different than saying all members of the chatzer that is required to do it. Nobody said the residents whose chatzer are off the alleyway, right? There wasn't a mavoi in the Mishnah. But Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's policy, if you will, is saving money for numbers 3 and 4 and requiring money to be spent by numbers 1 and 2. Does his line of thinking inherently say that we still require numbers 3 and 4 in this situation? That seems to be a very closed-off area. I'm now asking a question on the question. Mind you, I don't have the answer from the Gemara. Do you think that Rav Shimon ben Gamliel's line of reasoning would require numbers 3 and 4? Bobby, this goes back to the comment you're just making. Should 3 and 4 participate if only 1 and 2 have to build a gateway and a door?
Does the value of the gateway increase the value, or does the gateway increase the value of the 1 and 2? Or 1, well, 2, 3, and 4?
It's a good question. I don't know about ancient appraisals.
Are they more desirable? Is it more desirable? I mean, I don't know.
I think it's closer to the public thoroughfare.
Having had this experience, so we live on a dead end. We're the last house. And we learned at the closing that the roadway to our house is actually a private road, the last little bit of it, the last couple of hundred yards.
Uh-huh.
And there are two houses along there,
mm-hmm,
before you get to ours. So we own the road. That's what we found out at the closing. We own the road.
Wow.
Which makes a lot of sense, because...
But you have responsibility to make sure...
Yeah, no, we have the responsibility, but the reason that we own the road is, if someone else owned the road ahead of us, they could impair our ability to get to our house. So that's when I look at this. I'm saying, if I'm in 3 and 4... I have an interest in what 1 and 2 are going to do if this is the only way to get to 3
right
and
place.
4. So I just, my immediate response is 3 and 4 have to have, if not a veto power, they have to have the ability to express a concern if 1 and 2 wind up doing something that literally chokes off their access.
Gates to
1
and 2 just keep people out of those cuts of the road. They don't keep 3 and 4.
Well, I don't
no, but wait. According to what Barry's saying, here's a koshi. By the way, I wanted to do this because I wanted it to feel like maybe as Anshe Ha'ir, we would be interested in what the Ziknei Ha'ir are doing in terms of policymaking, right? And if these Mishnayot were created by way of the community that really discussing these issues, we're right now in potentially one of the kinds of discussions that they had to have, right? So, all right. 3 and 4 have an interest in what 1 and 2 are doing. If, by the way, the policy says that 1 and 2 have to build those gateways and doors, that leaves me more open. And when the people spill over because the traffic is so heavy on those certain days and they're looking for a space to create a repass or to find a way out of this maze, then I will have to worry. So do I have an interest? If I'm a Chachamim, is there interest to have not only equitable spending in terms of the policy of this alleyway, but is it also to make sure that since I've required 1 and 2 and they're not going to open the gates, I better require 3 and 4.
So you say that we force 1 and 2 to put a gatehouse, but if the people who are the resident of Chatzer 1 or Chatzer 2, the two families or the four families that lived there decided we don't want the gate. Anshe Ha'ir or Ziknei Ha'ir still can force them to do so?
No, but the issue is about whether you're required to contribute. The problem here is that 1 and 2, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, saying, first of all, is it clear that Ruvi Yot means obliged as opposed to appropriate? In other words, it's clear that this is Tikkubai. Okay. The problem is that 1 and 2, let's say there are just two homes in each chatzer. Both residents have to contribute to the gate.
If they decided to do so.
Because he's saying it's required. But in 3 and 4, where it's not required, let's say one family says, it's really important to me we have one, then the resident of house 4 gets the benefit of the gatehouse without being obligated to contribute. So I would think that if 1 and 2 were required, then they would be equal, because there's no one to say that the distance, the way it's drawn here, there's no one to say that the distance from the first two that you reach, that to get to the second two you have to walk 6 miles. In other words, it could be 100 feet down the road. So they are that much more exposed. But the question is, are you obligated to contribute to the construction of the gatehouse if you live in 3 and 4.
No, but so in the example of where Barry lives, if the city forced him to put a gate at the beginning of the road, your other partners to the area that shares your road, but it's your road, not theirs, can you force them to collect money to put the gate?
Well,
you can't.
Well, not only that, here, even if they want to contribute, I can never let them, because if they start contributing,
then they take
my right to say that's really my road starts to get eroded.
Correct. So that's
but
exactly
what
I'm here. So
if they don't have an easement, they must have a right.
Yeah, they have easements. They for sure have easements. But I'm just saying
they can use the road, but they
I don't want to do anything that might make it appear as if they own a portion of that road.
By the way, that could lead to our decision making about whether or not we can put a gatehouse or a door at the front of the alleyway. Because we don't want to have anyone claim if, indeed, only one or another has to do this, a la Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's policy, that the other people are required to have to live with such a door and a gateway.
But my assumption when I said that was that that's where the gatehouse goes, and 1, 2, 3, and 4 are all the residents of all those cups of road would have to contribute.
Right.
Now that I understand what he's saying differently, confused by it, because if the issue, as I said, is who's required, not whether you're forced to construct one, but it seems to me the question here is who's required to contribute.
Right.
Right. So in 3 and 4, then everybody isn't required, but if somebody wants one, it means there are people who can be deadbeats and get along with the benefit without having to contribute.
Okay. So for right now, that's true. And we have to leave it at that because we don't know whether or not they're all required if they start to do the building project, according to this piece.
Oh, of course.
And let's now bring it to the level of what we learned about Elijah and the story about tzedakah, because all this relates back to our tzedakah thinking and the ethics we have when it comes to the poor. Let's say it's a really, really big, heavy traffic day. The Rashut HaRabim, the thoroughfare, is filled with people. Part of those people are the poor. They do feel as though, while they're in the city, they have some right to ask for the help that they need, right? So
you're saying they're begging?
I'm saying that, I don't know if I would actively call it begging, but I would say that in the ancient system of providing for the needs of the poor, that there's some kind of public...
An obligation.
There's some kind of obligation, and there's some kind of way that poor people in public spaces are able to ask for the tzedakah that we're obligated to give. Now, whether that's begging or whether that is systemic, like
soliciting,
or they all kind of gather outside the gate together, and there's a moment in time where, you know, there's some tzedakah. Let's hold all those questions and see if the texts reveal any of that later. But if I have some that are open, and if I have some that are closed, where are the poor people more likely to go?
To the open ones.
Obviously, right? To the open ones. So part of this also, if it is about how I regulate my residents' maga, their encounter with the poor of either the people who live here in this community or the poor who are passing through, the Chachamim might have an interest, in other words, in creating doorways and gateways to make more of that kind of regulated interaction between the poor of the city and the poor who are passers-by and the residents of their town. And if the Chachamim are smart, like some of our folks who we'd like to have exercise their smarts about regulating the encounters with those who are really out there looking for the tzedakah, even if they deserve some, then we would expect that city administrators, policymakers, would come up with policies that actually contribute to not only a safe community, but a community in which the impoverished get their due at the right places, a la the soup kitchen, and a la the moments that I say, okay, the gateways are open for those who are poor to come and ask for their needs to be fulfilled. But maybe the Chachamim's reasoning is not simply that the thoroughfare is crowded and they might come through, but I'm thinking now knowing about the first story with Elijah and the whole dialogue being about the poor and getting the poor their due, I'm thinking, oh, maybe the Chachamim's policy is actually informed by how the city space and the residential space works when it comes to the encounter of people with a little who can give the tzedakah and people who are poor and who may just find themselves in the courtyard asking for a little something.
You don't want to guard a gatehouse arms race, right?
You don't, right. Because if I only require it of X, of 1 and 2,
right.
And 3 and 4 are the places they go all the time, right? And they say, no, now we're going to really fortify.
Right.
Yeah?
Yeah,
that's what you mean, right?
Yeah,
so I think that's true. So I'm not saying that the Chachamim made the decision like that. I can't hold that because it's not written explicitly in the text. But I think what we need to do sometimes in terms of an ethic that informs the way we create policy for the way we administer cities, city administration, works like this. We know it. Whether or not, you know, the police can or can't come shuffle the folks to the right shelter, whether or not we have spaces for them to go, whether or not we have open centers for meals at any given time that we can bring people to provide for them, whether or not we allow for the folks to sit and shake for their coins, their dollar bills, their food outside of McDonald's and on 86th Street and in our neighborhoods. These are things that inform some of the way we make policies on the books about what either things, you know, police policy or the policy of how we build or the policy of what we build and open space that we keep. And so I think here I could be in safe space to say that there is a way to look at Chachamim's and Shimon ben Gamliel's discussion in terms of tzedakah playing some part of it.
In which case it seems ironic to me. Maybe I'm overthinking it or just thinking about it incorrectly. But if the ones closest to the street require the gatehouse, and it seems to me the people who can live in those huts are open to be the people best able to afford to build the gatehouse. So 3 and 4, which can be open, just by the way things work out, tend to be where the people with less money live, who are the ones least able to be giving tzedakah. So the wealthier people are the ones who get protection from the people seeking any kind of help.
I hear you're making some, let's say, assumptions about who can afford which.
Yeah, definitely.
So if we go with your assumptions, and if we go with that, Svara, then right. Then we have to think about how the policy is affecting those with and those with less, right? And that too, sometimes is part of the shikul. It's part of the way we balance out policies for different neighborhoods and what we allow in different neighborhoods and how we ultimately ask them to pay certain amounts of taxes to provide for the needs of those who are in need. So I agree that could have been part of the discussion as well. I think the Chachamim, though, because remember, Rebbe Shimon ben Gamliel is the minority opinion, Chachamim generally is the accepted way to go here, and everybody's got to build these.
So what exactly do the guardhouses, like if I were a guard in the guardhouse,
mm-hmm.
what would be my duty?
You might say, who are you here to visit? You might say, it's like a doorman.
It's a doorman.
Yeah, these are gated communities. These are, like, let's say, at the little community where I spent a week in Pennsylvania. Okay, so you could say it's one gatehouse for this group of houses around a lake. So they want to know, are you coming to visit somebody? Are you only coming in to use the lake because really you don't want to pay the price of the public beach down there?
But they can also say, I'm going to visit someone in 3. I'm going to visit someone in 4. And would they be responsible for, I mean, they could be responsible, gatehouse 1 and 2 could be responsible for looking out for the people in 3 and 4.
You're right, like people look out for each other, it's true. If you go with the diagram here, so gatehouse and door number 1 and 2, it's not like it's at the top of the alleyway and asking about which one are you going to, 1, 2, 3, or 4. They're kind of only interested in what's going on in their own little world.
But if you imagine this, an alleyway, I mean, I don't know if what the Hebrew word actually means.
So Mavoi, it means an alleyway.
All right. So an alleyway,
passageway,
by its very definition, is narrow.
Yeah, it's not so wide.
It's not so wide. So if you have a gatehouse here and a gatehouse here, you're taking up quite a bit of space in the alley. So you can't just walk through, because now, I mean, you can just walk through, but obviously someone's going to try to stop you and say, what are you doing in this alley?
Is it inside the alley or is it inside the courtyard?
Well, it's kind of on the edge of the courtyard, off the alley.
So it's not in the alley.
Not in the alley.
Because the alley is public space, right?
Right. So, but you're right that the system is trying to create some regulation.
But it seems to me as though the important thing is the fairness of people living in very in close proximity, and this goal of privacy and protection, and that there's a responsibility for people that benefit from this privacy and protection to all be involved with the upkeep of it. So,
yeah.
So one is not doing it. So it's, I mean, along the way we get a sense of what's going on in the city and what's going on with the haves and the have-nots and
right.
and that kind of thing. But to me it's, you know, it's the fairness of people benefiting from a contiguous and almost joint area and, mm-hmm. you know, who bears the cost of it, and they're saying, you get the benefit of it, everybody pitches in.
Right.
And they help.
You're absolutely right. That's the essence of it. And what I'm suggesting is that you also have to, based on the fact that the Gemara started with the story of Elijah that we read,
right.
I believe that that's very informative, that like the first story out of the gates after the Gimel Mem of Gemara, Gemarinon, I believe that that's very informative vis-a-vis if you're looking at the Talmud, in a nomos, in a narrative, legal kind of way,
right.
that we can't divorce ourselves from the notion that internal to the discussion of who benefits and who pays is the ethical issue
right.
of tzedakah and how we work here as a community vis-a-vis our relationship and our encounter with who's impoverished in our precincts. And so, no, it doesn't like completely hit that on the head every time,
right.
But I believe the way that I'm looking at the Gemara
right.
is not always so typical to say this story of Elijah after we're done with it and we wrap it up and we get informed, kind of is a way of reading into the next unfolding passages that seem very legal and very, you know, this brisa was really only about this. I am suggesting we need to let that infuse the rest of this legal discussion.
I'm thinking of these arrows. This is going to be very complicated, whether you're going to have one large arrow or small arrows for each house. Where's the shul? It sounds like establishing arrows.
Well, thank God. We have a whole Masechta Eruvin that's as thick as Masechta Shabbos, deserves its own, even after we dealt with the issue in Shabbos, that deals with how to put one in the Chatzer, how to make one for the Mavoi, whether or not you can make one in the Rishut HaRabim, you know,
yeah.
So... that is very complicated, and it has a whole Masechta unto itself, and, you know, they're not dealing with that in Bava Batra.
Just another thing to keep
yeah, yeah.
But what I was thinking was, we've just spent, you know, like, and almost 40 minutes say, discussing this, and, you know, sometimes when you read this, you think, this is so minute. You know, they're getting down to such a level that it's, you know, it's really almost minutiae, but
we're doing
the same thing. I mean,
Rana,
which is good. I'm not
yeah,
saying
yeah.
it's bad. I'm
right.
saying it's
they,
the way
when people say
it.
This,
that's when they say Talmudic, this is what they mean.
Right. Exactly.
And when people say this, they don't realize, just like you're talking about your house and your road,
yeah.
and you're talking about your apartment and who puts what here, this is about real people and real life. And my contention, again, about pushing this back in, that this story of Elijah is so important, is that the Jewish discussion about all this is about, yes, all these little details, and which one, and how are we going to make it most equitable, and the Shimon ben Gamliel versus Chachamim Machloket, who's got which position, and you should remember that it's all about not only how you live, and with whom you live, and with whom you pay for things, but the tzedakah ethic that you need to have implanted within the build-out of your city, within the build-out of your courtyard. And that, to me, is very enriching and very exciting, and makes the minutiae also multidimensional. Multidimensional. So let's push forward. Let's now go to the wall, okay? And we can say that we got to a little bit more text tonight after the 34. Here we go. Kofi no toliv no la'ir. So now we're talking about the compelling the resident to help build the city wall. The Gemara is going to have a similar discussion regarding the two opinions that we heard expressed in the Mishnah, that the Chachamim Omrim, everybody has to be obligated for this, and Shimon ben Gamliel, who points out, not every city might require this. Okay, so, quote, Tan Rabbanan Kofino Tolasot La'ir Dilat Tayim V'riach. The rabbis taught in this Brisa text, we compel him to make for the city doors and a crossbar. So Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, and Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, not all cities require a wall. Ela, here an expansion of what we had in the Mishnah. Mishnah was shorthand. The Brita, the master of the Brita says, ah, I have this longer tradition. I understand why Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says this. Let's see why he says this. Ela, ir, hasmucha, l'sfar, re'uya l'choma. A city that is very near the border of some other land, not our own, some other people's administrative area, not our own, some other city, not our own, some empire's domain, not our own, a city over there, that city requires a wall. V'she'ena smucha l'sfar, eina re'uya l'choma, and a city that's not near the border, don't worry, that city doesn't need a wall. That's Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's thought. So you're close by, or you're not close? What's the issue? Ah, someone might come and invade. How do we know we're in the context of invasion and for that the chomah is for defense? Because of Rabbanan's answer here. Rabbanan, for Rabbanan, the question is, and why the chachamim, why do the rabbis suggest everybody needs to do this and every city seems to need a gatehouse and a wall and double doors and a crossbar? Zimnin demikru vate geisa. It sometimes happens that invaders will come, right, from far beyond and into the land where these other cities exist and come to attack a city interior, and thus everybody needs the protection of a wall. So the rabbis are concerned, and the rabbis say everybody has to put up defense, and therefore we require everyone. Now, how do we apportion?
So
here we go. Boy, mine Rabbi Elazar mi Rabbi Yochanan. If you're going to make everybody pay for it, because that's the assumption of the Chachamim, how do we actually tax the people? Or what's another way that we can say, let's say tax the people, or what's it called? Assess. Is there a difference in the law, by the way, of an assessment versus a tax?
It depends on how it's enforced. Assessment, the tax, passed by the legislature, that it's enforced by legal means, but an assessment can be within a community, and the question is whether or not they have the right to assess and where that assessment could be enforced.
Uh-huh. Okay. So I think this is more about taxation. I think it's more about taxation, because Rabbi Elazar is asking Rabbi Yochanan. Now, stop and pause. You now have a discussion of financial matters by sages inside the Gemara. It's not exactly clear to everyone who writes about the history of monetary policy, taxation policy, that the rabbis had all the power to create the tax code. To others, when they think about the ancient way that the sages functioned, they did know that certain sages were really excellent with finance, really excellent with city administration, and really did create the kind of policies we're talking about. Whether or not, as I mentioned before, this was a tight group of sages who were elected or appointed or somehow empowered, and I say that purposefully because the history of voting is not clear in the Talmud. Though there is the history of the Anshei Ha'ir, those people who are the 12-month residents or who bought the houses, appointing the Ziknei Ha'ir, the policymakers in this case of the city, which is a line from Brachot, and it's also mentioned in another place over here in the Bavas, in the Bavas. And so, if we're talking about those who were given the power by the Anshei Ha'ir, these were some of them. So I'm imagining this is probably from that kind of system. And they weren't just debating theoretically, that this was policy discussion, is my point. Well, let's get back inside. Vay minei Rabbi Elazar mi Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Elazar inquired of Rabbi Yochanan, Kshehen govin, when the city administrators collect from, in other words, the citizens, the Anshei Ha'ir, people of the city, lefi nefashot govin, are they collecting from each person in a household? Is it a head tax? O Dilma, or rather, lefi shvach mamon govin, or according to the wealth of the individual family. So what does that sound like? The debate between
state tax or collection per head?
Income tax.
Right. A head tax? Or?
A wealth tax.
Income tax.
No,
well,
wealth
doesn't say
tax.
Income,
no,
it's wealth.
Shevach mamon is not income. Shevach mamon is wealth.
So, I was thinking about it in terms of an income tax. You may be right that it could be a whole picture of the person's wealth and their standing wealth year to year.
That's you know, you can be rich and not have income.
The note makes it clear.
Oh,
that
the note is... Like,
well, the note, if you look at the note now, 28, Rabbi Elazar queried as follows. Do we say that since most... I'm sorry, not that note.
That's a good note.
It's note 28.
It is note 28, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Second paragraph. According to the first possibility... When reckoning the relative wealth of each household, only movable property is taken into account, since invaders do not usually damage buildings and despoil fields and vineyards. However, if it is known that the invaders intend to capture the city or burn it to the ground, even a household's real property is taken into account, since each family stands to lose everything. Now, this note, which is why I didn't go directly to the note to begin with, you see above it said Ritva. That means there's one of the Rishonim, whose name is the Ritva, interprets it to mean that. So that's... Art School will provide us many times a summary of one position that they feel is oftentimes the best position. But there are other interpretations from above. Whether it's real and movable property, whether it's not real and movable property, whether it's the stuff that you have declared and not declared, we're not exactly clear from the text.
But you have to be really careful about setting these metrics. So, for example, if you do it as a head tax, that's going to have the possibility of reducing the number of children people want to have, even though they're supposed to have a lot.
And you collect from the poor, don't have the money.
So, and, just like in Amsterdam, they tax based upon the frontage of their houses. They wound up with very tall, very narrow houses. So,
because they did it for like this.
Yeah.
They measured across?
Exactly. That's why
there was a system by the size of the windows.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the policy until when?
I forget exactly when, but I'm just saying you have to be really careful.
6-foot wide, 8-foot wide houses all over Amsterdam. They're still
and that's the reason why, because they're taxing property like that?
Yeah.
They have to lift the furniture up the window.
So
all
right,
the time.
That's why they have the hooks on the top of the houses so they could lift things to get in, because there was too narrow.
Go up the stairs.
So if you're going to set tax policy, you will affect
behavior.
Right. And how you do that, then you need to think through absolutely pristinely, because the unintended consequences can
unless
be very,
very good.
Profound.
Very good. So now let's
unless there's a value reason why, an ethical value reason why. So those that have should pay, and those that don't shouldn't pay as much.
Yeah.
That's what it seems to say.
Right, but getting this just right.
Each point stands in and of itself. Tax policy can indeed affect the popular kind of outlook on whether or not one wants to live in that society, and how many children one ultimately has, and all these kinds of things about what you want to establish and buy. purchase, how you're going to save, whether or not it's going to be movable property or it's not going to be movable property, if the REFA is right, you know. And the point stands that, yes, an argument might be, if we especially, if we see the tzedakah ethic within the narrative, which is better, ultimately, to take care of all the needs of the city. Which gets into yet another layer that I would like to discuss, and that is, think about this as we read the end of this little section. If we're talking about the wall, and the double doors, and the crossbar, and it is for defense of the city, forget for a second that it's about how we and who we count in the precincts and who's really a resident here and if the residents of the city get their due first or they don't, because we'll get to some tzedakah laws about all that stuff. But think about it in terms of this tax and other kinds of needs that we have in the city, because we got to pay for those too. Remember we started, I read you some of the Mishnayot. You have little building projects to make happen in your own courtyard, and then obviously there are other needs in the community for all kinds of things. What is better for the city by way of monetary policy? Again, the headcount or starting a system of taxation that assesses people's wealth and says some portion thereof should really be contributed for the city needs.
Well, I think the way they're writing it is it may come to the same conclusion, but for a very different reason. So I don't think they're looking at equity here. I think what they're looking at is who is going to benefit the most, which is may get you to the same spot, but it gets you there by a very different route. And so I think conceptually they're very different in terms of thinking about the policy. So I don't think this is designed to, you know, to equalize the society. I think it's designed to apportion the cost as related to the definable benefit.
Right. So in this case, it's true. And the benefit in this case right now in this little section is the wall.
Yeah.
And the defense
right.
of the city. I don't think, though, that we can completely, again, divorce ourselves from the fact that we're talking about a greater city and its construction, and then how that affects the population, as you suggested, even with decisions about family. And I'm going to, again, add the layer of the poor and how we relate to the poor of the city.
So I can't help but, because I've talked about this on Passover and things, so I'm fascinated with the little bit that's in the Torah about tax law, if you will. So on the one hand, the half shekel. So whether you're rich or poor, you have to give exactly the same amount. So that's unequivocally a capitated payment and totally disconnected from wealth and disconnected. So that sits there. That's the flat tax, if you will.
Right.
And then you have the fact that you have to allow for gleaning. So by definition, gleaning is going to be a graduated tax, right? Because the bigger your vineyard is, the more of your produce is going to go to the poor.
Right.
So you have within the Torah two very different conceptions of taxation for the common good. And I think that sort of underpins some of this, but what I see here is really much more economics than social justice. The social justice may come in terms of what you have, your obligation in terms of the poor coming to knock on your door, but this looks to me as if it's really trying to stay within the bounds of defining benefit.
So we're going to keep it in those bounds for right now, and we'll see how it's related even more explicitly to the social justice component in your last construct. But granted, we are in the discussion of who's paying for this wall, and it ultimately Rabbi Yochanan says to Rabbi Eliezer, Marlei, Lefi Mamon Govin. So according to the wealth, we're going to collect this tax. It's not going to be a head tax. And we're going to collect it that way, so that we can really pay for this. And he says, Ve'elazar, B'ni, enlist in my son. Rabbi Yochanan says this when it comes to how we're going to tax. And it's not going to be the head tax. It's not going to be the capped half shekel. He says, Kvave Masmerot. Put a nail in it. In other words, when you think about tax policy for this kind of endeavor of building this project, this is the way that you have to do this. And this tradition is established here, and this legal matter is a closed case. There's no more discussion. This is a very uncommon phrase in the Gemara. Very uncommon.
No,
so uncommon. So uncommon.
It's over.
That it doesn't appear anywhere else.
Really?
This kind of legal rhetoric, for whatever this moment in tax policy, monetary policy discussion, is really a moment where there is no discussion. Is it for fear that you only might have the least possible amount of public funds because everybody's got to participate? Because what are you going to do when you're asking the poor people to pay the same flat tax as the wealthy? Well, you're sure not going to get it, right? Maybe they were so concerned that that's the reason why this expression comes. But this expression is so unique in the kind of rhetoric of the Gemara when it comes to addressing a question of which direction and how we do the halachic reasoning, and then what we say is the conclusion. Could have said halachaka, could have said the law is like, could have said, and that's the takana, could have used and hem tiknu. By the way, that might have been an interesting verb if they would have chosen that verb, because of what we studied last year in the Beit Midrash here about Tikkun Olam and the fact that they did have it in their power to make takanot when, and there's so many places with, no, but this is really is, the discussion is closed. Nails in it. Okay? So, if you have a thought about why that is, I'd just be interested to hear your take. But, very interesting rhetorical device here in terms of legal reasoning. Yes, Ron.
So, Yishuv Sfar, a city or a little ayara, town by the Sfar, is usually, although rich people can live there, but will never have money to put a wall and a double door and a crossbar around it, in any place in the universe. So you need to have a central government to subsidize this Yishuv Sfar. Otherwise, nobody will go to live there, and they will never be protected.
It's an interesting question you're asking.
And there are
do the border cities have enough money and have enough people with money to actually afford these kind of building projects that they're discussing? Well,
and they say they should have the wall.
Yeah.
Here's don't have the money.
The initial response in the Talmudic age is this, that the cities we're talking about were, if they were on the border of these places, very important cities on trade routes. We're not talking about major cities that had, like, we just built it up because we thought this was a nice little area.
It's not Rome and it's not Jerusalem. We are talking about Tzipori.
We're talking...
So the people in Tzipori, the 50 families of Tzipori, never ever had money to put a wall around.
We're talking about cities that may indeed have to take enough of... They have to take enough of a collection. They have to take enough of a collection to do this. And so you... You know, we have to ask ourselves, which are the walled cities? Now, we could go for a moment to the beginning of Masechet Megillah to talk about which cities were walled at the time of Yoshua ben Nun, and we can talk about which cities seemed to be walled at the time of the rabbis, and that's part of where we're going to find those informative pieces. We're talking about, though, not so many, and we're talking about big enough centers of Jewish population where they did have the ability. And so
I don't believe that those Yishuvim were Yishuvim Sfar.
They may not have been. They may not have been, and therefore we may have been in this time of machloket about it where the policy is being created, and even quote-unquote on paper and in the Masechtot that we're living with, it may have seemed to say one thing, the Chachamim might have held that, and guess what? Just like the Chachamim say, everybody should be keeping Shabbos like this. maybe not everybody kept Shabbos like that. So even if the ruling comes out, I can't guarantee you that every city
will
have it.
But I'm surprised.
But we can say that the policy is being created.
The Rabbanan were sitting in Jerusalem and dictating a law that's supposed to go for...
Yeah, we don't say that they're all in Jerusalem at this point. As a matter of fact, we say a lot of them are in Bavel, looking
okay,
back on what happened in and near Jerusalem and in and around Israel, and we see that a lot of this is parallel. Yes, in the Yerushalmi, in the Yerushalmi Talmud, we're not learning the Yerushalmi Talmud. There's some differences. There are some differences. We're not going to get into all those differences in the minutia, and we may not even be able to say that every one of them had. But we are saying this is the policy, and we are saying that the Babylonian Talmud says this is the policy, and for the most part. We haven't done every dig we need to do and the layers that we're talking about to really understand whether or not those cities were or were not.
Do you know when Ritva lived? When Ritva, the commentator?
I don't want to give you wrong dates,
okay.
But he's in the Middle Ages.
Middle Ages.
Yeah.
There's much.
Yeah, later. Okay. So let's say that let's go to the next piece. Ikadamri, there are those who say the following, that the dialogue went like this instead. By Mine Rabbi Elazar mi Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Elazar inquired of Rabbi Yochanan, same to when administrators Shehen Govin Lefi Keruvatim Hen Govin. Do they collect also according to the proximity of the houses to the edge of the city? Those that are really right up against what would be the wall, the edge? O Dilma Lefi Mamon Govin. Or perhaps they collect according to the wealth of each household. Rabbi Yochanan comes back, Amarle. Lefikeru batim hen govin. The administrators collect from each of the households according to the proximity of the house. Ve'elazar b'ni, and Elazar, kva ba masmerot. And nail it to the wall. Nail it down. Put nails in it. This is the way that some report it. They don't report it like the last conversation, though it ends in the same place. No more discussion. Now it's different. Do I collect from the people who are right at the edge of the city, who have and they have to build the wall because they live at the edge of the city? Or do I tax the wealth of every household here in the city? And what does he say? Just those on the edge.
Unfair.
Oh, is it unfair? So let's talk about this in today's time.
According
to proximity. So let's, okay, fine, edge, proximity, how far, but these ones who are not that far don't have to participate.
Well, they don't have to pay
as much.
Oh, they don't have to pay. So that's the question. Is it they don't pay as much, but they still contribute? Or is it that they don't have to contribute, and only these do? Here's about the unfairness. Here's the parallel question that I want to put on the table. And with that, look at exactly what it says in the Gemara. Lefi keruv batim hen govin. The administrators collect from each household according to the proximity of the houses to the city's edge. So it seems like what?
According to, it seems like it's a scale.
According to the scale. The Elazar b'ni kavaba masme wrote, and Elazar, my son, fixed nails in the ruling. That's the ruling. Now, look at what Art Scroll did. Look at what Art Scroll did. Art Scroll adds a little bit of a dimension into the middle paragraph here, right? So, he says, the administrators collect from each household according to the proximity of houses to the city's edge, as well as according to relative wealth. As well as.
Combination.
Right.
Now,
but the first statement said that.
Let's look. You think the first one said it?
I think the first time he said both.
So let's look at the first one.
No.
You mean the first one back this way?
No.
He says, they collect according to either a head tax or to the wealth of the families. That's the first discussion.
That's not
second discussion. There are those who report, do they collect according to the proximity of the houses, or is it they collect according to the relative wealth? So possibility number one in my book. The first story was the established policy and law, generation number one, let's say. And then, the city administration sees that that's not really giving us enough wealth to finish this project. Generation 2 of city administration comes along and says, how are we going to fix this system? Oh, we're going to attach a proximity clause to the way it's collected. And they say, if you're closer, we need more.
It's a total disincentive, though, to live by the wall.
Closer, you mean further? No.
Well, is it closer or further?
Do you want a nice view or not? If you're getting a good view, you're going to pay more.
The closer you are to the wall, the more vulnerable you are to invaders. And so therefore, you want to pay to be downtown, away from the wall. That's what
I was thinking the opposite. That the closer you are to the wall, the more interest you have in making sure the wall goes up.
That's not correct, because then if something happened to me, the city needs to compensate me.
Wait a minute. There's no compensation clause. This is not insurance.
It should be the other way around. The guy who sits leaving the city center needs to pay more than the guy.
Okay, I can go with your Savara.
I think it's back to the
proximity could be nicer houses. They could have a beautiful view.
I don't know about that. They're not talking about being on top.
I think it's back to the same first principle.
Oh, no. I don't think so in this case. I really don't. But here's the thing about being so close to that danger zone. And let's say it is the, for a minute, let's go my direction first. We can try to play this out. If I have to pay more and I live closer to the wall because I have more danger, is that parallel to somebody who builds the house in Malibu?
On the cliff.
On the cliff. Is that parallel to someone who builds in the new kind of places where I can rebuild in New Orleans today? Is that, you know, the spots that are hurricane prone, do they have to pay more to the insurance pot? We all buy the same, quote unquote, homeowners insurance. Should their premiums be more? Or should their premiums be the same as everybody else's? Because equitably, we all say we're living in the same country, same space, and we better make sure that we all contribute to that big pot of insurance money. Is it the same issue exactly? I don't know, because we're not talking about invaders coming in and potentially taking wealth.
No.
But it's kind of, to me, the same issue in terms of some of the kind of policies that I wind up either paying a higher premium for or lower, depending on the fact that when I live in, you know, in the danger zone versus when I live in this zone that still is an earthquake zone, but I live inland.
I have to pay more. I'm
going to have to pay more based on the risk that they're taking over here.
So we have a couple friends in Arizona. They have 150 acres in the desert of Arizona, and they have snakes and tigers, and you name it. So they build their own walls around their own area to protect from those dangerous animals to penetrate to their private space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So why does the city need to pay for them?
The difference here is you already have the house, and the administrators make a rule that changes the premise upon which you bought the house. It's like an ex post facto law. And, you know, that's a problem.
Say it again, I'm sorry.
When you own the house, you bought the house, and then while you're in the house, they say, oh, you've got to pay more for the wall because you're closer to the...
They didn't have the choice of buying it.
Right, this was not a model community, and we're going to build a new one over here. That's, I'm not assuming.
He didn't know that when he bought the...
I mean, maybe he did. Maybe he did.
But your risk is still high. If you knew that, that's a different story.
But
if he didn't know, you're saying you can't come back. So in my narrative approach that it was like an add-on, that would be unfair, according to the legal ruling.
But the principle, I think, is exactly the same as we saw before. Because that person is going to... would have been the one who most likely would have been invaded, that person is going to be getting the greatest benefit from the wall that protects them from that invasion. And therefore, they're apportioning a higher fee to that or a higher tax to that person because from an actuarial standpoint, they are getting the greatest benefit.
Right.
It says these are different ways of looking at it. And it depends on who your local marauders are.
That's right.
If your local marauders are guys who just come for wealth, that's one thing. But if you know your local marauders are going to come and kill everybody, then you should pay it per tax based on the per capita, because then everybody will be getting equal benefit.
Yeah, they're,
so you have to know who your marauders are before you can decide which is the fairest tax. And if they're just going
to
come and take your TV set, that's movable property. But if they're going to burn your house to the ground, then it should be apportioned based on the total, including the asset value.
If they're going to kill everyone, then the same fee per person thing applies.
Right.
But there are still two options for if it's just for your property, and I'm not clear yet because I thought it was one way. But it's unclear as to whether you pay more to live far from the wall.
Let me tell you according to the text in Rashi which ones we're talking about.
Okay.
So the text that says you're going to charge those people who are in proximity of the wall, right, more. So look at what Rashi says. Kiruv Batim. I'm six lines up in the Rashi, maybe? So those houses we're talking about, assessing, okay, according to proximity, it just says Beit or Bayit HaKarov L'choma, those closer to the wall, as Barry just said, Tzarich L'choma Ir Yoter Min HaRachok.
Yeah, I thought it was the other way around.
Yeah, so Rashi has at least the tradition that the ones closer to the wall really need the bigger protection. You're bringing a nice question on that, though, saying which house seems to be the one that you should ask for more money, because is it worth asking for more money from the one inside because you're far away from the danger zone, regardless of how your marauders act and what their plans are, which you can't always know. And so the assumptions of the Rishonim that you can actually know what the marauders are doing, like with Note 28, it's a nice group of assumptions, but the Gemara itself didn't say that. And we're not exactly clear if security professionals have assessed for every city and how marauders are going to behave.
So let me tell you how I think it would play out.
But just one second, though. There are two possibilities, and I think I was thinking one. That's probably wrong. One is an army comes in to take over your town, in which case it doesn't matter. But maybe what we're really talking about here now are thieves who don't want to get downtown. They just kind of want to hit the ones near the wall. And then
that's right. That's most likely.
So that's why I was thinking.
That's most likely.
Okay, so what we haven't discussed at all is the price of the house. So I could easily imagine...
I missed it.
But I'm just saying if the price of the house in the middle is 10 times the price of the house on the periphery for just the reasons you said, even with the tax, this may still be a whole lot cheaper than this one in terms of carrying costs, if we will. So until you really know that, you can't make...
I mean, if it's assessed on the value of the house itself.
No.
It's being assessed as what was...
Proximity.
So we have proximity plus whatever wealth is in that house, right? But so all I'm saying is that without knowing the house price, you can't really judge the gradient, and it may well be that those in the center are worth infinitely more than those out here, even if these guys are obliged to pay a higher tax. What?
There's an adjusting mechanism.
Yeah, that probably was.
It would be wealth in the house that could change.
Right,
yeah.
Movable property. So here we go. Here, let's make a quick chazara for the end of the evening. Excellent, excellent. This is like real Talmudic stuff, right? This is where the pedal hits the metal, where if we don't use some of the assumptions of the Rishonim, we really ask the same questions that the Rishonim are asking, forget their conclusions. It really came alive tonight, Yishar Kochachem. The notion that the Mishnah wants to have some type of, whether it's equitable or not, system for having contributions to these requirements of both courtyards and cities has become clear. clearer in terms of when Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, here's why I may not require those places to actually have them. The Chachamim who require of these places to indeed have them cross the board leave us with the questions that we were dealing with and that we were discussing, and that is, who participates? At what level do they participate? And we know we've got to come up with some policy in order to really make that happen. And the next question that we're going to look at in terms of our Gemara, which will not be the week of Thanksgiving, but will be the week after, and I'll wish everybody an early good Shabbos, and God willing, see you here for Shabbos, where we're really celebrating our connection to the New York Common Pantry and saying Yishar Koch to those who have gone and volunteered, and hearing from Stephen Grimaldi, the executive director of New York Common Pantry, around 11:35-40, so that we can understand issues of hunger in our city and the response of New York Common Pantry to that issue as a sponsoring shul of that pantry. So I'm making the invitation. Next week, an early happy Thanksgiving and good Shabbos. We won't see each other in the Beit Midrash Wednesday, but the following one, we will get back into this issue, and we'll hear about whether or not, forget the guy who lives in the house close, forget the guy who lives in the house downtown, whether the Chachamim get parsonage, and whether or not they have to participate in the tax at all. Very important discussion, I should say, for all shuls everywhere throughout Jewish time.
So I know the business I'm going to go into is the storage business. I'm going to open up a storage depot in the center of the town and get all of the people to put all of their stuff from the periphery in my storage.
Nice.
And that way they'll lower their